All right, so welcome to the next episode of the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast. This is Brant. We've got with us Mirth, who is quite mirth tonight. Howdy, Mirth.
Hey, thanks for having me 20 minutes later than scheduled.
But yeah, well, you're here, aren't you?
I am.
I gave you 20 extra minutes to pound bourbon. You're fine.
I'm drinking red wine tonight.
Oh, okay. Okay. Had to cheap it out a little bit.
Yeah, I'm on a budget.
Yeah, and then our good buddy Jim is back with us. Howdy, Jim. Jim is back with us? Jim is not back with us?
His icon is with us.
His icon is with us. What happened to Jim?
He went to bed.
This is awesome. He shouldn't have. He's an hour behind the rest of us. Jim, your mic's not working. Now we can make fun of him. His mic was just working. We were just talking to Jim a minute ago.
We've lost Jim. Oh my God, what happened?
He's dead, Jim.
Perhaps he felt the need to refill the libations to blend in with you there.
Well, keep up. He's good luck with him keeping up on that.
Yeah. So,
he's still showing up on the call. I don't know what happened. Jim!
This is going to make for some great podcasting, let me tell you.
I love it.
Hey, we're not editing this out. Why would we?
God, no, I hope this is going out. The whole thing.
At some point it will. We were intending to talk about all the gaming we did over this past summer. It's going to be a little tougher if there's only you and me talking about this.
Well, I did some gaming this summer. Oh, he left.
He left. This is awesome. All right, we're going to stop this recording and start over. Oh, he's back.
Did I come back?
You did come back.
You're back.
We were getting ready to dump the recording and start over because we're 2 minutes into this and all we've done is wonder where you were.
Okay, did I go away just then?
Yes.
Okay, but I'm still with you now.
Yes, you are still with us now.
Okay, because I'm trying to turn down the ambient on my mic because I was catching so much of my background in here. All right, good. I'm here. Sorry. I'm back.
It's almost like you're a Jedi who's you know, sort of conquered death or something.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
Your dreams were your ticket out.
Out. Mr. Carter, Mr. Carter, ooh, ooh, ooh.
Mr. Carter.
You guys worry me sometimes.
That worry me a lot.
This yeah. will go on for days.
So, welcome, Jim, to our second episode of Mentioned in Dispatches here.
Hey, hi.
Yeah. The whole plan here was to talk about what did we play over the summer. The whole theme of the episode, you know, I know what you played last summer. So you know, I know in your case, some of what you played tied in with some of your vacation, which is why we're going to start with Mirth. So, Chris, I know you did a bunch of gaming this summer. What all did you knock out over the summer while you were off on your gaming weekends?
Been playing a lot of this game called Rommel. Which is a miniatures game, but has a sort of board gaming influence to it. A couple of my buddies are big into that now, so we've been playing that. What else have I been doing? Some sort of medieval Renaissance stuff on a fairly regular basis with my local group. And that's it for the summer, because it was kind of a quiet summer for me.
So if we go all the way back to... go all the way back to Huzzah, because I don't know that we've talked to you since Huzzah. What
right,
all did you get?
In May, did a bunch of games then, some naval gaming. Still playing General Quarters on a fairly regular basis as far as naval stuff. We like that one a lot. We're getting ready, actually, to gear up for some Fire and Fury Age of Eagles. I've actually played some Age of Eagles Franco-Prussian War stuff. Just that Huzzah, and I've done it a couple of times since. Those are great games. That's Bill Gray, his whole system, Age of Eagles, Fire and Fury. So yeah, do a bunch of that too.
Okay. Any particular favorite from over the summer?
Good question. No, I still like playing Baroque, which is, it's Baroque Impetus. Impetus is a system for Ancients, and Broke is their medieval version of that. I still like playing that because it's a simple rule set, but it has some nuance to it, so it makes it equal to gaming. We just did a game like a couple of weeks ago, which was a lot of fun. Anytime we get a chance to do that, I enjoy it. I like that's the one system where when you play it, Dragoons actually work as a unit type. Pretty much any game I've ever played with Dragoons, they just are useless. In this game, they actually work because they get to they're mounted riflemen. They get to fire rifles, but they get to move as mounted units, and it actually works in that particular game. So, been playing that, like playing it. We'll hopefully play it again some more. In my group, my local gaming group, we make a joke because anytime I buy the rules for a game, we seem to never play the game again.
So, a quick question for you then, because we all know what a cardboard game whore you are. If you're playing all these minis games, are you borrowing armies, or do you also have, you know, another room of your house dedicated to giant racks of lead minis that you're painting and not telling us about?
I have a crap ton of 28 mil World War II Germans, literally an entire army of them, and that's it. I don't, as far as these other games, like the Renaissance, the Civil War, I don't collect the figs. I don't paint them. I show up and I play the games because what I've learned is in any group, there are guys with a ton of lead and they just want a chance to have them on the table. So that's what I do mostly. I mean, I have World War II infantry. I have World War II fighter planes. I have some lead. I do not have nearly as much lead as I have cardboard. And when we play these other games, I'm really not looking to collect because I'm sitting here looking at stacks of games around me. I've actually become kind of a hoarder. I mean, it's a little scary.
Kind of?
No, definitely am. I mean, if I bump the wrong thing, there could be 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 games that are going to fall on top of me. So
it's amazing you got a girlfriend.
It really is. I'm looking at Panzer, MBT, Holland 44, Next War Poland. Lock and Loads of the Pacific War. I mean, this is all I can see right now from where I am sitting within 6 feet of me. So it's not healthy. And I'm getting ready to go to Compass in the fall where I'm probably going to buy 5 or 6.
Yeah, I got to ask, how many of those are punched?
I'm actually pretty happy because I just punched At Any Cost Metz 1870 from GMT, which I've owned for at least a year. But I punched it, and it's ready to go. Haven't played it, but...
All right.
And in my hand right now, I have my Oregon Laminations 2.5mm corner counter trimmer.
That's too bad we don't have Vance on the call. You could clip a few next to the microphone just for the audio sensation of it all.
I'm going to bust out Holland 44 and just punch the shit out of it right now.
Jim, what'd you play this summer when you weren't gallivanting around Europe and shooting YouTube videos for us?
There was much gallivanting. I think the biggest thing is, and it's funny because I have an absurd game collection too, but since I've been able to play miniatures games, particularly on the Saturday Night Fights with the Armchair Dragoons, I've been able to release something that I'm not completely comfortable with, which is, like every other miniatures gamer, I have an incredible case of ADHD. You know, you sit down and you attempt to paint a battalion of French line from the 1809 campaign. Great, I started over halfway through it. And suddenly you're flipping around your YouTube channel and you notice somebody is painting 28mm World War II infantry. And you go, oh, those would be really cool to paint. So go get to those and you start painting them up and you buy all the paints and the brushes and everything. And by the time you're halfway done with that squad, you suddenly look up and realize, oh, there's these wonderful ships that Langton puts out at 1200 scale. So I've been able to really try to see just how far I could push it when suddenly, because of Tabletop Simulator, I could just cut and paste as many miniatures as I wanted. I have built some absolutely absurd setups, including a full Black Powder 2 Quatre Bras table. That I think has something approaching 1,200 figures on it. I just finished my Trafalgar set, which has all the ships for Fighting Sail, which we've played online. But what games have we played? We've made our way through Black Powder, Toygenhausen, with a couple fits and starts. We've actually had, speaking of Rommel that Mirth was talking about, something else from Sam Mustafa, we've had a lot of fun with Blücher, which
is... Did you play Blücher on Saturday Night Fights?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, Doug and I busted out Osprey and Esslin, which, by the way, we could have used you for, because we discovered maybe when you're learning a rule set, you don't take one of the larger battles.
Yeah, it's a big one to do. That was with Blücher, though?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the same basic rule set as Rommel.
Well, Rommel's got those squares
that
you deal with. This is more linear. It's actually a little bit like his Grand Armée.
Okay.
But no, it's a great, Sam designs great rule books. They're direct. You understand them. Yeah, he'll have a quirky rule or two that we had to puzzle through, but he also answers questions quickly. So yeah, Doug and I are, I think, on unfortunately, Ross McGee, who's become a friend of the Armchair Dragoons from the Old Meldrum War Game Group in Scotland, he's the guy that gave us the map we could use and a lot of the OOB. He did the research for it and did a great, great, great job with it. And so we stole his stuff wholesale, and he's very happy about that.
I got to pay more attention. I didn't know that's what you guys were doing for Asper Nestling.
Yeah. We're, as a matter of fact, though, when we're done with that, we're probably going to do Toygenhausen. We're probably going to start up Toygenhausen. Yeah. But the one I really want to, and I'm going to probably do a comparative piece for the site, I'm going to do Ekmul in Sharp Practice, Blücher, and then some Black Powder. And then I also want to do it using the wargaming company's Et Sans Resultat, which I've really, really gotten into, and it's a complete mind screw. If you've spent your life, as I have, playing Napoleonic miniatures games, it does things that very, very few sets have ever even tried. And I think I like it, but I'm not sure yet, to be honest. Sure. So, no, we played Blücher using Osprey and Esslin. And what else have we gotten to? And most recently, and it's been terrific fun over the last 2 weekends, a bunch of us have gotten together and made our way through 2 games in the SPI 30 Years War Quad online.
Yeah, I see that. I mean, I saw that you were playing it.
Yeah, and it's
the problem is, if I don't have my kids, and then it's this weekend, I'm usually playing with actual human beings as opposed to...
Yeah, they're playing with actual
human beings. We're just remote from each other.
Well, hold on, Jim. Slow your roll. One of them is Banzai Cat, so we're not 100%. Yeah, we're not 100% sure that they're all human beings.
Right. Well, no, and it was in many ways the SPI Quad was a response to Marco Arnardo's review of a war game. Quite frankly,
you did hold up air quotes around review, right?
Right, I did. An attempted, you know, very strange commentary on the game Undaunted by our friends. So we did that. So, you know, we've done that. So we've been able to play so many really, really cool online games. I've spent a lot of time doing that. I've spent a lot of time building other sets. But we've also played some Sharp Practice too, which I really enjoy. To do that with the Armchair Dragoons has been a real highlight of the summer, just being able to get together on Saturdays and move virtual lead around, because not all of us certainly, and what's one of the reasons I wanted to do it is because I'm not fortunate enough to be proximate to a regular group of miniature gamers.
I want to bring something up here, just you know, we're gonna drift into hot take land here momentarily.
Oh dear.
No. So when we were discussing something on a previous podcast, we were talking about the differences in wargame design through the ages. And one of the criticisms that was brought up is that, you know, the old Avalon Hill Panzerblitz CRT was the same CRT that they used over in, you know, the Waterloo game. And yet here we've got Mirth pointing out that the Blücher rules are essentially the Rommel rules, and nobody bats an eye and just keeps right on discussing playing the game.
Well, I may have oversimplified that, but I mean, the idea is the designer's the same. And the thing about Rommel, I'll say this, because I've played it a number of times now, and a couple of the guys that I game with are pretty big on it. It's a miniatures game, but it's a miniatures game board game hybrid. I mean, you're playing it on a grid.
Yes.
You know, and the way you move and use the pieces, even though it's miniatures, it's very much a board game type of feel to it. So I've had my problems with that because I really don't, if I'm playing a miniatures game, I'm not playing a board game, and I'm pretty hard about the separation between the two. And I play a ton of board games, so don't get me wrong. But I'm not really looking to recreate the board game experience on a miniatures table. But at the same time, I've played the game now a number of times, and there's some nuance to it, which I appreciate. I mean, it's not just a straight board game thing. And so I imagine that's kind of the same. I've looked very closely at Sam Mustafa's games now, and I have an appreciation for him as a designer that I didn't when I first started playing Rommel, I guess, is where I'm going with that.
No, and I think that that's right. I mean, he tries to do things. He's a thinker about, you know, we talk a lot about board gamers because they get all the attention because they're the bigger market. But there are some guys in the miniature game space that are really thinking up some cool things.
Yeah.
And certainly Frank Chadwick was the guy that gave us the idea of a Napoleonic brigade on a 3-inch square base. But what Sam has done in both Grande Armée and now in Blücher has taken that evolution to a really cool place. Doug and I both very much like the system, especially for what it is. It's a relatively fast playing, allows you to play the big battles in a night. You know, it's not – and as we're grokking the rules better, we could easily see – you know, you're not going to do it in a two-hour session, but you could crank out a Vagram in a day, which
– Well, that's exactly how it is with Rommel too. You can do, you know, an entire 3-day battle in 16 turns in 4 hours, which there aren't very many systems that allow you to do that. And when I say you play, you're playing it to completion. Like, you know who's going to, you know, maybe you don't get to all 16 turns, maybe you get to 12 turns, but you know who's won at 12 turns, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, actually, it's funny. If you watch the video of Doug and I playing Osprey Nestling, you'll see I've got, as the French, a few more turns. I just want to see how they go.
Yeah.
But just because I'm curious to see how the system manages, but I've pretty much screwed the pooch, and it's pretty much over for Napoleon in this one. You know, I'm probably going to have my morale collapse and all that other stuff. But yeah, you're right. And I think, if anything, that may be Sam's biggest emphasis. He wants the game to be played to a conclusion. And a conclusion that everybody playing both sides is like, yeah, maybe I didn't like the way that turned out because I lost, but I lost.
That's and I'm not going to say. You just nailed it right there. And that's how the rules are. I mean, that's how the entire system is. You may not like what the rule is, but it's very clear what the rule is. It's very clear what the system is, and in the end, it's very clear what the result is. You may not be happy with that result, but, you know, when you look at the entire thing, the way the rules are written, the way the system is set out, I mean, it's designed to work a certain way, and you either accept it and you play within it, or you just don't play the game, and that's the bottom line.
Yeah, and it's funny, because I've been going back and forth between these aesthetics. You know, Blücher is 3-inch brigades. We actually use, they're slightly, the counters that that Ross McGee's crew came up with are actually the size of index cards or playing cards, actually. And so they're a little shallower, but it's whole brigades on that space. Whereas Etzan's Resultat is 30-millimeter squares, each one representing a battalion. But you move, it's an amazing system. You move the entire formation, which is typically a brigade, and you move that, or I'm sorry, it's a division, and you move that division in a column, and it's a strict column until you get to the point where you want to deploy them, and then suddenly you pretty much get to move these little squares anywhere you want within their movement allowances.
Yeah.
And he wants those to be very organic formations. This is David Esnes, and he wants these to be very organic formations, and they have reactions and fights that are very different from anything. The only thing I would compare it to is if anyone has ever played Patty Griffith's Napoleonic Gaming for Fun. I love that title.
Implying that none of the others are for fun.
For spiritual edification.
Yeah, the rest of them you're not playing for fun, you're playing for the slog.
Right. You know, playing for the slog of it. He's got a divisional game that is very much like this game, and I've got to ask David if he if he derived that sort of thing. So I've been, that gives you a very different aesthetic of the lines laid out and defending the terrain and formations building and deploying and then marching. Whereas with Blücher, you're getting these blocks of troops and they're all brigades. So it's been some very cool experiments. And again, you know, talking about what Mirth was mentioning in terms of his ability to reach out and use other people's toys, I will always play people's toys. But the reason I painted so many miniatures back in the day, I had nobody around here that was going to paint them. Right. So I had to do both sides. And then I would have people over and say, hey, well, you want to play Civil War? I got both sides. Or Napoleonic, I got two armies. Now I can build armies for as many people as I freaking want. And they look good enough. And they're played out. You know, my wife is great with building terrain. You know, she draws the maps for me and does the counters for me. And we wind up having these really neat games. Her greatest triumph so far is the Teugenhausen map, which is really quite lovely. And as having visited there now, it actually looks like it, which is cool. So, no, it is a great it's a great playground, a great sandbox to be able to play in and to really have all the miniatures that I wish I always could have had and to share them with friends.
Well, part of the reason why we are playing Rommel so much now is because a bunch of my buddies all have a crap ton of World War II 6mm stuff.
Okay.
And this is a game that suits that. And so they can put all their cool-looking stuff on the table, and we can play a game in an afternoon. So, I mean, that's why we're doing it, because they have the minis. They have all the cool toys. And this is a way we can play a game in 4 hours or 5 hours to completion, which is not typical for most of the rule sets that we play, to be honest. Even well, with 6mm, I mean, you're talking, you know, you could easily play a day or 2 days just to get through a scenario. So,
yeah, well, I mean, you know, shoot, I've poked around with Chain of Command, and it's an interesting system. I love the Lardy stuff. I will always play the Lardy stuff, but you know, you got fewer than 30 figs on the board either side, and you're soaking up hours of time.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, I mean, I love big games. I love deep games, but there's definitely a mentality now where you set it up, you play it for 5 hours, and you're done. You know, that seems to be where a lot of people are moving towards, just because.
Well, yeah, I think that's why Black Powder has taken over Napoleonics the way it has.
Yeah. I've played a number of games over the years, like huge games, where you spend more time setting the game up than you do playing it, and that's a turnoff for a lot of people.
No, and you know, Black Powder out of the box is essentially you've got a division, let's say, you know, two brigades and some support. Both sides have it, go, and every one of those rules is written around just keep it moving.
Yep, sure.
You know, and yes, I absolutely agree with you. I'm surprised, you know, for example, the Lardy's just released through the Reisfitz imprint General d'Armée, which is a very interesting system. I bought it, I have to have it. But I can't imagine anybody playing this. Yeah. I know people do, and I know people must love it, and I hope they really do love it. I hope they super enjoy it. But I'm not going to teach it. I'm not going to do it. It's just not going to be something that's in my purview. I mean, frankly, I can teach Shaco on the back of a napkin, but I don't even presume to try to teach people Shaco anymore.
Yeah, no. I get what you're saying, too, and I'll tell you what. Even with my own group, and we play a lot of games, but we've been playing a lot of really simplistic stuff lately, and I'll play it, I'll push the lead, but I'm not really invested in it. And we've been doing a lot of Osprey stuff, like Lion Rampant and things like that, and yes. I bought the rules for Lion Rampant. It's not a bad rule set, it's a very simple rule set. And I've looked at, like, Osprey's cranking those out, like, these very simple rule books for like $20 each, and they do it for a ton of stuff now, all the way through from medieval ancients all the way through like Spanish Civil War and whatever. I congratulate them because they're fast playing, they're easy to pick up, the rule books are very accessible. It's just not something that like it's not something I really want to be invested in. I mean,
You're raising the exact right issue. I think your key word is there. Is anybody going to invest in Rebels and Patriots?
Yeah, yeah.
you know, what's to invest, right? You need, what, 30 dudes? Uh-huh. You know, we actually did Rebels and Patriots for Saturday Night Fights. It was Jason Pratt versus Vance doing a Napoleonic scenario.
Yeah.
Well, one of the funny things is you talk about cranking them up. First of all, some of the games are radically undone in that series.
Correct.
Chosen Men, for example, is a disaster.
Haven't played it, but I get what you're saying.
And of course, that's the one I want the most, because it's
the notion. I know, that's why I was looking at that, actually.
It's the notional Napoleonic one, but if you read between the lines of some of the comments of the guy who's designed Lion Rampant, which of course becomes Dragon Rampant, becomes, I forget what the name of the 17th century one is, but also becomes Rebels and Patriots, it's clear Osprey told him, we already have a Napoleonic game, it can't be yours. And so he just sort of hints at, well, you know, you could do this for 19th century stuff without too many changes.
Right.
So Rebels and I, we played it that way. But no, I admire what they're doing and the fact that they're trying to get it to the point that people feel they can take out six figures and suddenly play a game. You know, oh, look, I got eight guys to unit. Okay. Sure. Okay, and if that's what you enjoy, then you should do that. You should enjoy it. I'm gonna want a couple hundred, you know.
I'm with you, and I don't. The thing is, like, there's this heavy emphasis now on these skirmish type games where it's exactly what you can field 10 or 15 or 20 guys, and you know that's the unit. You know, you can have whatever you're gonna call it. You know, a retinue, or I don't, you know, whatever. Right. You want to break the unit down.
The author keeps coming up with new words for the aggregations.
Correct.
Because he knows he can't bloody well call them battalions.
Well, no, because that's not the game you're playing at all anyway. I mean,
right, it's this group.
The thing is, like, some of these time periods don't lend well to skirmish. They simply don't. I mean,
well,
I've seen people playing Civil War with 28. I'm not interested remotely in doing that. And like, 20 guys in Civil War, 28. You know, that means nothing to me.
Do we remember the game Flintlock? LOQUE.
I don't.
Where they had the orcs in the Napoleonic period.
Okay, that sounds about right.
Yeah, I remember the first time. And
weren't those just the Belgians?
Wow. Brandt goes after the Belgians early in the holy cow. It was big. There was a game store near me. It was the last one that I had that actually had a group of guys that were historical gamers that we could just, you know, all right, who wants to play DBA tonight or whatever? And I came in one night late after work. There's a bunch of guys, and they're, you know, and you know how some game groups are. They don't care much about terrain. Maybe half the guys aren't painted. There's, you know, they're not trying to do the display. They're just trying to play a game. But even with that limitation, I think they probably had eight guys on a side. And they said, and they looked at me, knowing me, and they go, hey, Jim, we're playing Napoleonics. Check it out. And I looked over and I went, no, you're not. And I guess, again, I want to be very clear. If that is what floats your boat, go with your bad self. But
yeah, I'm really not trying to knock it. I guess the point I'm trying to make is
I'm with you. That's my point.
Yeah, I mean, I just like certain time periods lend themselves to certain scales. Like, I mean, 28 mil Civil War and a point that's not the right scale for the time. It's simply not. It's just not. The units didn't function on a squad level. They didn't.
Well, look, I mean, shoot, we're always caught in the golden glow of our own time. I actually went back and I pulled up the rules for the first Napoleonics that I ever learned. It's called Grand Tactics. It was a locally created thing from the local store, thousands of miniatures on a side, right? Except that the scale was one dude to 20, so it's the Empire scale.
Yeah. Okay.
And in a game that was supposed to be able to take on Ailau, they had rules for opening and closing gates in fences.
Yeah, that's just absurd.
and I'm going, what? You know, I'm reading this all these years later. You know, this is now nearly 40 years ago. And I'm going, we really did this? This was a thing we thought was right in terms of scope and scale and the telescoping of the battlefield and all that.
If we tried to do that now with the group that I have, we would murder each other. There'd be blood on the table.
Which, there was at least one World War II rule set that I remember that there was a note in there about having the appropriate winter attire for the Germans in Russia, that there was a chance that they would take damage each turn on some random roll just because they didn't have the right winter gear with them. The default answer is to make a joke about it being ASL, but I don't think it was ASL. I just don't remember which one it was. So, yeah, there.
No, and if you want to play that game, I'll go straight to the point. If you want to play that game, you want to find the spiritual equivalent of Napoleonic ASL.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is, but, you know. You know, I suppose it's probably Sharp Practice, which I do enjoy.
It might be that mano a mano game from the old Dragon magazine that we covered on the video way back when.
Oh, yeah.
What I think is fascinating is when you're playing any miniatures game, and I'm not really, the scale has nothing to do with it, but you take a Napoleonic game with 15mm, mm-hmm. I mean, the units represent a certain size of unit, and the terrain represents a certain scale of the terrain, but you have guys, like, literally, like, down on the table, like, look, I can see that unit right there. Like, I'm here. You can see it. You know, with a laser pointer or something, like, well, yes, true, you can, but that's not really what the game is trying to capture in this, you know.
That's great.
But guys still do, with miniatures, they get so hung up, like, on the, you know, the terrain and the, like, oh my god, I can see him, like, right there on the hill, like.
Well, it's my two favorite stories. One's very new on the topic. It was the time that I realized doing the math that, you know, if you've seen my website or my Twitter account, my Facebook page enough, you've seen that I've got Kriegspiel blocks on it. The fact that Kriegspiel blocks, as small as they are, get the half battalion frontage right, but they are wildly too deep because if they were accurate, they'd be roughly the size of a pencil lead.
Yeah. You just paint up some toenail clippings.
That be on a tabletop.
Well, I'll give you a hobby. I got into the hobby miniatures wise, doing 28mm World War II, and we used a game called. It was originally done by EZ8. It's called Battleground World War II.
Sure.
And within that system, if you look at the ranges the way they're, everything is compressed because you have to play it. You know, these are 28mm figs, but you have to play it on a table. You know,
less than 1 mile wide.
Correct. If you looked at the ranges for, like, the 88 in that scale, the 88 could be on the table and shooting two blocks away and hitting a target, like, if you were going to play it realistically.
Yep.
So those are the kinds of arguments, like, oh, that 88, because you're playing it on an 8-foot table, so then you're saying, well, the 88's a...
Uh-oh. Hey, Mirth, I think we lost your audio, dude.
Mirth go?
Mirth go. Mirth gone. Mirth going, gone. Which is too bad because really, I mean, we've gotten like, you know, 30 minutes out of me asking two questions and you guys just going. This is awesome. I sound like the world's smartest host for just getting out of the way. I love this. So.
No, maybe get him back.
He'll be back at some point. The unfortunate thing for the Saturday Night Fights for me, and I've mentioned it in some of the chats that are there, I can watch Saturday Night Fights. The problem is I work Saturday nights. I moonlight over at the local indoor soccer place here. And so I'm running the concession desk and the field check-in desk on Saturday evenings. And so I'm not able to participate because you guys are playing at a time when I'm at work. And so I can watch, but I can't jump in and participate. And so that's unfortunate. Cause I would like to, but I can't, given the fact that, you know, I'm working. Oh,
sure.
So, but I hope to be able to one of these days. We'll see if my schedule changes up.
It's an absolutely wonderful space, and I really encourage anybody. Look, if you've got a PC, I guess I got to stipulate that. But if you've got a PC and you wait long enough for Steam, you're going to be able to get this thing for $9.
Yeah,
or less actually. And if you've gotten – and right now – I'll just pull it up real quick because I always like quoting the very latest number. I am right now 569 hours into this thing, and I'm not stopping anytime soon because there's just so much you can play. And whether it be a good old-fashioned SPI game, a modern GMT game, or a tabletop game, they've got them all. And yeah, well, as we go forward with the Saturday Night Fights, I've been publishing to the workshop all the games we play. If we play it, and I didn't, and it was designed by me, so like our Sharp Practice stuff, our What a Tanker stuff from Two Fat Lardies, our Black Powder stuff, any of that, I'm putting online.
Well, don't get too far ahead of us, because we are in fact going to talk Saturday Night Fights on one of these nights when we talk in greater detail about it on one of our upcoming podcasts. So don't blow it all away here, giving away all the tips and tricks and discussions.
No tips, tricks, and discussions. Very good.
I do want to talk to you some, though, and this does tie back a little bit into the Saturday Night Fights. You got to make, well, it's not really a road trip when you got to get on a plane to get there, but you went touring around Upper Bavaria this past summer, checking out the locations of a couple of the battles. I've been through Regensburg, spent a night there. I was also like 11, so I wasn't really paying that much attention to any of the battlefields around there.
You were my son's age. Well done.
Yeah. I think we did in fact actually stop at that same restaurant that you guys did, the world's oldest wurst shop there. I'm pretty sure we did hit that one while we were there. Talk to us a little bit about sort of what it was about those particular battles, some of the gaming you might have done or read or researched or looked into before you headed out there, and kind of some of the inspiration that it gave you coming back from those trips.
Sure. Well, first and foremost, it's sort of this march through history that's only taken two steps, I guess. But we started 2 years ago when Doug and I and some others started up playing the 1806 Kriegspiel, the Jena-Auerstadt Kriegspiel, in the forums. And we just kept at that. And we published the videos. We got some really nice notice of that. And so Doug and I got together and said, well, what do we want to do for the next one? You know, we've already done 1806. I've been to Waterloo twice. I've done that a bunch. And along the way, when I went over there in 1806, I visited Leipzig and some of these others. But we said, what should be next? And I actually got a hold of Didier Rouy, the guy who designed the Flight of the Eagle, the system we use for the online Kriegspiel. And he said, you know what? Do 1809. It's actually my favorite scenario. And so based on that, really almost exclusively, although we were already interested in it, we decided to play the 1809 Kriegspiel. Well, that meant not only the setting up the Kriegspiel, and now as if you go to the forums, you'll see we're actually running two separate implementations of it, Doug refereeing one and I'm refereeing the other, both fully subscribed. So we've got, what does my math tell me, something like 25, 28 people playing at the same time, which is really, really cool. So we've got all these great, really inventive guys, and I'm going to boast again because I'm going to do it every time that I can. Professor John Gill, who wrote the definitive books on the subject, is one of the players. I can't say who, but he is he's one of the commanders. So we have that, and obviously we have our usual cast of characters, including Vance and some of the others. But that sent me down looking at the other games, Kevin Zucker's 1809. And The Last Success, which is the four battles of Eckmühl and Abensberg and Aspern-Essling and Wagram. So I said, I want to do these battlefields. I want to go to these places and see these things. And so we broke the trip into two parts, and I've already written about part of the first part, which is the bit up at Regensburg and the area around there, and heading down to the battlefield at Teugenhausen, which is one of the preliminary battles. But you know, it's interesting because I really am fascinated by the fact that some of these battlefields are very well curated. Waterloo is the great example. I mean, the whole space is a museum on par with Gettysburg. I think Gettysburg's better, but it's still a remarkable museum, is Waterloo. Whereas some of them, like Jena-Auerstadt, are pristine. They're not curated at all, but they're still very much as they would have been 200 years ago. And so seeing that, and doing that, it affects you in big ways and small ways. From a big ways perspective, driving back and forth across that space, especially in the first part, because after a week in Regensburg, we drove all the way over to Vienna, and that's where I finished up Aspernessling and Bagram. It gives you a sense of the size of the spaces that they were maneuvering over and how really, you know, it's a smaller space than you think. You know, you think of these sweeps of battles, and sure, these were tough marches, but this was a real fight in a phone booth in some ways, given the number of men that you're talking about marching over these areas. You get a great sense of the terrain. You get a great overall feel for the place. But then on the smaller level, and I guess it's my standard example, and I wrote about this. I said, you know, there's this spot at Torben known as Kuberg, where you look at a million maps, and I've seen, not a million, but I've seen well over 20, maybe 30 maps, whether they be in a game or in a book, of the Battle of Teugenhausen. And you see this Buchberg, and you say, oh, there it is. And then you read about the fact that Davout, at the very start of the battle, fires up some men. He doesn't even bother to get him in formation. He says, look, we've got to get to the top of this hill so quickly, because otherwise the Austrians will have the advantage. Get up there, go, go, go. And it's not until you walk there and you sit at the spot roughly where they would have started that assault and you look up to that hill and go, oh my God, I would not have done this.
Yeah.
And it really gave me the strong impression, and it was only reinforced with some of the other visits we made, whether they be the rest of Teugenhausen or something I'm going to write about next, which is Eckmühl, and certainly in a major way, Wagram. I was really struck about this by Wagram. We do hills all wrong. We just, whenever we do these miniature tables, we either abstract them out in a map because we don't have a good sense of depth, or we build them using our war game terrain hills, which are fine, you know, in their own way, but they're ultimately fictions. You know, like Mirth was talking about before he was so sadly disconnected.
I'm back!
Hey!
No, go on, please, go on. I'm agreeing with you.
No, I was just saying that, you know, we build these tables, and we're very proud of them, and, you know, whether it be the standard birthday cake, the layer cake look, or whether we try to put some books under a rug, or whatever it might be, when we don't get that right. And I'm really of the opinion, and this is a task I put my beloved wife to, because she's a far better graphic designer than I am, I just want to do them drawn. You know, we're going to miss it no matter what. And to Mirth's earlier point, it's like, guys, your ground scale, let's pick a sans resultat. Let's just take Blücher. Your ground scale is 1 inch is 100 yards. Your 25-millimeter figure is 1 inch tall. That means if there's any correlation, which there isn't, he's 100 yards tall.
Right, yeah.
So that's a nonsense, and that's fine. I'm not saying that doesn't stop me from enjoying it. He's my little marker. But that's what he is. He's a marker.
He's a
dashing, cool marker. What matters is the physical space he occupies.
But as soon as you put that little dude down, whether it's an individual or a stand, and as soon as you put the terrain down, people get very hung up on that.
Yep.
Very hung up on it.
I I'm going to call out here, but all you got to do is watch the first game of Teugenhausen that we played with Jason Pratt. And watch how Jason treats the village of Reuth.
Okay.
Where he clearly is trying to develop some advantage based on half inches.
Yeah.
And like, I've now been to Reuth, which, by the way, is as close as I think I came to being arrested for trespassing. Because, well, most of these battlefields are still farms, which is really cool. Except for the fact that Google Maps does not distinguish between highways and cow paths.
Right, yeah.
And so my beloved
You're
wife
not marching in a Napoleonic formation down most European cow paths.
No. Well, not just that, but I'm in an Audi, because I wanted a Volkswagen Jetta or something little. But they're like, all we got is this Audi, so I'm driving around in this $40,000 car. And it's going fast. And my wife is like a little rally racer guide to my right, going, all right, in 5, turn left, 90 degrees. In 4, turn left, 90 degrees. And she makes me take this sharp turn at Wagram, and we go from a highway on which the posted speed limit is 100 kilometers an hour.
Sure, yeah.
You take this hard left onto, I'm not kidding, a cow path. And I look at her like, are you kidding? And she went, that's how you're getting to the marker you want to get to, fancy pants.
Right, right, exactly.
And so I'm in the middle of these farm fields, and you know, and you're trooping around and you're trekking around, and it's not until you get there that you realize we just don't, we usually, you know, getting hung up on this terrain is not something that is sustainable when you go and visit the space.
It either is or it isn't. I mean, I think, like, if you visit certain Civil War battlefields, you like, how the hell did they even fight here? You know?
Yep.
But then you're playing, sometimes you're playing a game where it's like a plus one or a minus one modifier. You're getting hung up on the terrain because you're playing a miniatures game, but that plus one, minus one means nothing in game, you know? So.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, it's even more simple than that sometimes. I mean, one of the things I've learned is I'm never going to play a game, no matter what it is, that treats a built-up area other than a built-up area, which is to say I can pull off every house from it if I have to and make room for the troops I'm trying to deploy.
Oh, correct. Yeah, that's another thing where, you know, yeah, these are discussions we could have.
People, I can't tell you, well, can I move my troops into this house? No,
yeah, exactly.
You can't.
Yeah.
Because that house isn't there. You know, that,
yeah,
you're
what house is, why the house is actually bought my troops then?
Right, and that's the thing. Well, the really interesting thing, you talk about things that Etzan's Resultat makes choices about. It says if you're in musketry range, which is 3 inches, so, well, at 150 yards, so within 450 yards,
sure.
You don't need line of sight.
Okay.
You can just shoot at whatever's in front of you.
Yeah.
You know, and it just said, because frankly, yeah, you're right. You're in a town. There are buildings there. So we're going to give you a negative because you're shooting around buildings. But you could still shoot through them.
Correct. Yeah. These are the reasons why we play games and have fights about rules.
Well, so to answer Vance's question, I think that started all this, it's, I go there because I do want to feel the history. I mean, one of the things I'm going to talk about at ECMA, there's a spot right outside of Unterleichling, that's on my, it might be my favorite Napoleonic battle spot, just because I was like, oh my god, I can see what they saw. I can see, and
correct.
By the way,
that's absolutely correct. I mean,
the German government gets all the Bavarian government gets all the credit in the world. They put these markers not in just some convenient spot by the road. They put them at key spots of the battle. So more than a couple times, we had to walk to the middle of a farm field, just a huge farm field, in the middle of which is a historical marker laid out like a giant book.
Right.
And the farmers are okay with you doing it.
Well, the crazy part, well, except for the one guy who was on the one-way road with his harvester, and he was looking at me, and my German's good enough, and he was looking at me like, are you going to move, or am I going to move you?
Well, and the other part is, like, so you go back.
And you're in a $40,000 car that's not yours.
Mm-hmm.
The blind firing thing is, I mean, this is an argument I've had many, many times. Nobody marches a squad or a battalion or nobody marches a unit up and just sprays an area because historically that's where the bad guys were. Nobody
right.
does that.
Right.
I mean, that's just not what happened.
Right, and it's well, and so you go to these places and you feel the history, but you also get a sense for what you get wrong on the tabletop.
Correct.
You know,
yeah.
what
yeah.
whether it be chit and counter, or whether it be miniatures, and you realize, and this is something Doug and I talk about a lot. Look, guys, it's an abstraction. It's a fun abstraction. It can even be an educational abstraction.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's what it is. And, you know, the very best games, the abstraction reflects the reality. That's what I learned. I mean, I've played a lot of games, and a lot of times I've played games where I'm like, that's so stupid. Then I go back and I read the history, and it's like, actually, the game had a pretty good reflection of the reality, you know. The game reflected reality better than I understood it, even.
And we were talking about this in the context of the fact that Kevin Zucker designed part of, we don't know what part, but the at least is given credit for designing some part of the 30 Years War Quad.
Yeah.
Well, the number one criticism of his CRT is that it's relatively bloodless. It is actually remarkably difficult. You can disrupt the crap out of Napoleonic units in his system. Killing them is another matter entirely. And he has defended this for 40 years. He said, look, that seems to me to be the record, is that you can push and push and push, but destroy? That's pretty rare.
And he's absolutely right.
And when you play these games and they make little simple decisions like that, you go, wow, those are the best moments. Those are those aha moments that make it so rewarding to be a historical wargamer.
I completely agree. I brought up the game we played, the 28mm skirmish, World War II. The biggest complaint people had was it wasn't killy enough. It didn't kill people fast enough. But if you look at the historical record for fucking squad on squad, you could shoot thousands of rounds to get a kill. I mean,
right.
So to reflect that in a game, it's like the game doesn't, you know, I can't kill guys fast. Well, you didn't kill. What you did was you suppressed. And
right.
If you suppressed, you maneuvered. Suppression allowed you to maneuver, and then you got the kill. The maneuver is what allowed you to get the kill. It's, you know, but people play these games, and I'll tell you, until not very long ago, I mean, regardless of the time period, I was very ignorant of the tactics involved, whether it was World War II skirmish or Civil War. But when you play these games and you're like, you can't kill. It's not about killing. It's about fire and maneuver. I mean, I'm not really – the time period is kind of like irrelevant. When you look tactically at it, it's about fire and maneuver. It's about suppressing and then maneuvering to kill. So you don't get the kill. You don't line up and get the kill. You don't get the straight shot. That's not what you're doing. That's not the point of it, you know.
Well, one of the great underlying debates in all Napoleonic warfare and history and simulation and war games is just how much melee occurs.
Yeah, exactly.
Because every war game you bump into, everyone with a couple notable exceptions, says, oh yes, melee occurs. The record is, except for defending a built-up area like a city or a town or a village, or if you had, for example, a redoubt like you did at Borodino, the odds of usually one unit approached the other one, started firing volleys, and then the other one unit or the other went boo and started to charge, and the other one ran away.
Think about it. None of these guys wanted to close because it got very ugly when you did close.
No, that's going to be – we're going to all die. You know, and
nobody wants to do that.
Their commanders don't want to do it because suddenly they don't, if they lose, even if they win.
Even if they win, they're still screwed.
They're suffer unsustainable levels of casualties. And there's all this new research that has come out, and certainly over the last 50 years, going back to the manuals of surgeons that served in these field hospitals and recording the types of wounds they saw. And there aren't too many of them that see bayonet wounds that aren't post-mortem.
Chris, you're talking about sort of the whole suppress versus kill. What's interesting, the numbers in U.S. Army artillery doctrine, there are different kinds of effects that you can request from your fire support guy. What's supposed to happen at the maneuver level is you're supposed to tell the fire support guy what effect you want, and he's supposed to figure out how to make it happen, whether it's calling on the guns or coordinating some aerial, you know, some close air support or whatever. But suppressing the enemy is only killing about 10% of them. Destroying the enemy doctrinally with fire support still is only a 30% kill rate. Like that's what the doctrinal standard is for you to destroy an enemy using fire support, is that the expectation is you fired enough rounds to kill 30%. That means 70% of those bastards are still out there. Which, to us war game types, that doesn't sound like something that was destroyed.
Well, that's exactly the point I was making, because especially when you're playing a miniatures game, when you're a gamer, you're expecting to just wipe everybody out. You're expected to kill everything.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And there's a difference between kill everything versus render it combat effective.
Correct,
those are two different things.
That's an adjustment that people have to make in their minds. You know, the thing I will say about, I played a ton of Fire and Fury for Civil War, and you're never looking to destroy a unit. What you're doing is you're looking to push it from, you know, fresh to worn to spent. And if you can get it to spend, you've driven it off the battlefield at that point. It's ineffective. You don't have to wipe it out. You just need to drive it off. You know. But
well,
those are things. Those
I would argue that that may be a
to adjust to.
So that may be a victory condition that's specified in the rule somewhere. I would say that, you know, whether it's kill everybody or convert them to spent or whatever, that should be a function of the orders given to the commander as a part of the mission when the battle starts, because there may be times when the point is to drive the enemy from the battlefield. There may be times when your mission is simply hold that piece of ground, and it's perfectly acceptable to sit on top of that hill, watch the enemy march right on by and not fire a single shot in anger. So long as they don't threaten you holding that hill, your mission is complete, right? Your job is hold the damn hill. And so if nobody tries to knock you off of it, there's no point in you coming off of it to pick a fight. And so when you start talking about in the game, you're supposed to move the guy from this to this to this, well, that's probably should be in some sort of scenario specific something that says, here's what your mission is for this game.
Yeah,
not...
I would argue, especially when you're playing, I'll take a Civil War scenario, especially because a lot of times you can play a historical scenario, and I could be a certain commander, but that commander didn't have specific orders, you know, he didn't have a specific, like, a scenario objective, like, so I'm commanding, you know, this corps, and I have an objective, but my objective, you know, you can't say, like, oh, you can only take so many losses, because that's what the scenario describes. You could do that, but that person historically never had those orders, like, oh, well, limit yourself to only losing these units.
You don't know that. They might have.
Well, they might have, but, you know, what I'm saying is, like, you can parse it out too finely, you know, so that what happens is, like, so I'm playing, you know, whoever at Antietam, and my objective is not to sustain the same historical losses. Well, you know, you can give me that in the scenario, and I'll play that out differently.
Yeah, well, but that goes back to what's the mission that you were given as the commander that you're trying to implement. And that's something that in a lot of war games, particularly the historical games, the mission is do better than they did historically. That's how you can get a German victory in the Battle of the Bulge, right? I got further into the Bulge than the Germans did historically. Therefore, although I'm not going to win the Battle of the Bulge, I'm going to win the game of the, you know, the Alamo. There's not a winning hand for the Texans at the Alamo. There's just not.
Right.
But you can make an effective game out of it by adjusting the victory conditions somehow. But what's the mission that you're actually giving the guy? And that's something that really appealed to me about a lot of those Cold War goes hot sort of hypotheticals. Like, there's no historical that you're measuring yourself against. Here's your mission. Here's what you're expected to execute. Go do it. Now, it's easier to draw the parallels between sort of those orders and mission statements in the modern context, because it's the modern game and a modern order system and doctrine that we're applying to it that makes all that a little bit easier. That was one of the things that I tried to do with the Warfighter series that I published way back when was, I wrote the scenarios for the players as a modified operations order for the, to look like an operations order you would receive in the field. Now, yeah, you know, we had to stretch reality a little bit to account for all the game stuff that's not in a real operations order. And there's a bunch of stuff in the operations order that was abstracted right out of the game that we were never going to address. We weren't worried about fuel resupply in the game. Right, we assumed that you had enough fuel to make it through the length of the scenario, and that's all we were worried about. But we, you know, the intent was to make it look like the kind of an order that you would get on the field, you know, on out in the field somewhere that says, go do this. And so your specific task was your mission statement. This is what you were supposed to do. Do this by this turn, and then your victory point calculations were on the back side of the page, because that's what we were after.
Well, it's almost easier to do that with the modern stuff, because if you look at the Soviets, they were very clear. Like, you can go back and look at the Soviet plan from 1985, and it was, you know, D+3, they needed to be here, you know, so you can game that out. Nobody had that in the Civil War. I mean, there was no, like, we needed to be here on this, you know.
Well, there was to an extent. For instance, you know, the boys from your backyard, right? The 20th Maine on Little Round Top.
Sure.
The issue on Little Round Top wasn't kill everybody, it was hold the hill.
Yeah.
Now, they had to kill some dudes to hold the hill because there were some guys coming up the hill trying to knock them off it. But once people stopped trying to come up the hill, all right, we're good. Hey, we've got the hill. It's ours. And there are even...
I've gamed this out. I've gamed Gettysburg to the point where we gamed it. We were supposed to game the entire 3 days, and somebody decided that Sickles didn't need to hold the peach orchard.
Yeah.
That wasn't made an objective. So, and I had Sickles, and I withdrew. I friggin' fell back as fast as I could because that was stupid. But that broke the game because if he doesn't hold the peach orchard, fucking Confederates lose. So
yeah. Now we've talked about that one before. Some the. You know, the issue that I was trying to bring up is that what's written in the scenarios is not often reflective of the kind of mission somebody will get on the ground, in large part because we're trying to replicate what was actually happening on the ground. Can you do better or worse than the original combatants did? Instead of necessarily...
This is the common stuff. Like, I have a couple of GMT games. I have the France 40 game for one. And you can play historically. And if you play historically, the French are going to get their teeth friggin' knocked out. And you can opt to not play it that way, and the French are more flexible, and then it becomes much, much harder for the Germans. And it's just, what kind of game do you want to play? I mean, the French can sit there, and they can march in. There's a couple of scenarios in that, and the French can just follow historically, and they're programmed to go into Belgium like they did. And then, you know, the Germans just blow through the Ardennes. I don't know. It's what you want to play. Do you want to play like a simulation, or do you want to play like a game where you can actually do, you know, because do you want to have to do the stupid stuff, or do you want to have to, you know, maybe not do the stupid stuff?
Yeah. Well, and I think that depends on, that goes back to design decision. We're fairly far afield from the, what did you play this past summer? But that's fine. Well, but that's fine. Like that's what we do here. You know, the discussions sort of travel about, and that's totally fine. But we are a little over the 1 hour mark. And so we are starting to tax what we ask of our audience to stay tuned to us and dial in here on Mention for Dispatches. So I think we may table the discussion at this point. Let Murth get back to his red wine and let Jim go crack open a cigar and a snifter of something. So, Jim, thank you very much for joining us and regaling us some on your travels this summer. And we are definitely going to talk a whole lot of Saturday Night Fights on an upcoming podcast in a couple of weeks. So thank you very much for being here.
Happy to be here.
And Chris, thank you for being just drunk enough to be fun and sober enough to be coherent. We do appreciate that.
It's a fine balance.
Yes. And so we will stop the discussion here and let you call your girlfriend back. And I do appreciate you taking time out for you to join us and thank her as well. All right, this has been another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches here with the Armchair Dragoons. Please come by and take a stop by our forums. Check out some of what we've got over on our front page and join the fun. And hope to see you guys over there soon. Thank you.